From VOA, Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we examine the phenomenon of truth decay. Our guest, Jennifer Kavanaugh, a political scientist at the Washington office of the RAND Corporation. That's a research organization that develops solutions to public policy challenges to improve the safety, security, and prosperity of communities throughout the world. Jennifer Kavanaugh leads the Countering Truth Decay Initiative at RAND, which consists of a portfolio of projects exploring the diminishing reliance on facts and analysis in American public life. Jennifer is also the Director of Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program. Her research focuses on U.S. defense strategy, international conflict and military interventions, disinformation, and the relationship between U.S. political and media institutions. Truth decay, or the blurring of the line between fact and opinion, has been exacerbated by extreme political polarization, traditional and social media echo chambers that often confirm pre-existing beliefs, and the dissemination of disinformation and misleading or biased information. The coronavirus pandemic, which has forced people to stay indoors and surf the web, has also accelerated the spread of false information, even causing some to doubt the efficacy of vaccines. The January 6th violent attack on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters, which resulted in at least 5 deaths, scores injured, and the destruction of federal property, is a consequence of truth decay, as those who engaged in this assault on the peaceful transfer of power, the hallmark of American democracy, were motivated by conspiracy theories and falsehoods. We'll ask Jennifer Kavanaugh to talk about the origins and main drivers of truth decay and how we can mitigate this deleterious trend, which, if left unchecked, could further undermine the social compact. And Jennifer Kavanaugh joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, let me ask you the very basic question first off. How do you define the term truth decay and what evidence for it exists?
Well, we define truth decay as the diminishing role that facts, data, and analysis increasingly play in our political and civil discourse and in the policymaking process. And we would point to a number of different trends as being evidence of truth decay. One is increasing disagreement about facts and data. You can see this in a number of different domains. One would be the safety of vaccines. As we get more and more information that vaccines are safe, we still have an increasing number of people who believe that they're not. Another trend that is a marker of truth decay would be the blurring of the line between fact and opinion. You see that in public policy discourse. You read it in newspapers. You see it on television. The way in which fact and fiction and opinion are blurred in a way that's really hard to distinguish. And at the same time, we have so much more information now, and so much of that information is commentary and opinion and people's takes on issues, that it can really overwhelm the facts. And then the final trend would be declining trust in institutions that used to be looked to as sources of factual information. So be like the government and the media. And this declining trust means that people not only struggle to figure out what's true and what's not, but they don't even have an authoritative source to turn to get that information.
Jennifer, given the proliferation of falsehoods, outright lies, conspiracy theories that so many individuals and groups take as fact, some say we are in a post-truth or post-fact era. What's your perspective?
Well, we don't really share that view, because while we do see a declining reliance on facts and evidence and data in certain areas, certainly in the policy domain around issues of healthcare, around topics like immigration and crime rates. So here we're talking mainly about public issues, political discourse. So we definitely see it there, but we don't see it everywhere. So if you look at other things like sports, baseball or football, the drive for better and more data and sports analytics to make teams perform better. If you look at how businesses are operating, increasing, trying to get data, whether that's data on consumers or data on their own performance to improve their revenue and their profits. Or, you know, another area where RAND works is the military. And the military is making great strides in trying to accumulate data to inform their decisions decision making and their strategies. So we see an increasing reliance on data and leveraging of data in certain areas, but not in this kind of public policy, political discourse domain. So to say that we're in a post-truth society would mean that that rejection of facts and evidence was everywhere, and we don't see that. So that's why we use the term truth decay to describe the phenomenon.
No, it just reminds me of former President Trump's senior counselor, Kellyanne Conway, who invented the term alternative facts, which in fact are really falsehoods. But as you say, that's not pervasive. And that's a good thing that in some domains, data and facts are truly critical and are not being doubted. So you talked about the trends that characterize truth decay. What about the so-called drivers of truth decay? How would you describe those?
Well, we focus on a number of different causes or drivers of the phenomena. Certainly one major one is changes in information technology, changes in the way that we consume and share information. And here I'm talking about the rise of the internet, the ubiquity now of social media platforms, the volume and speed at which information travels and is shared, the democratization of the information environment, which allows everybody to have a voice and a platform. All these things have both provided access, but also provided opportunity to amplify the spread of disinformation and for actors with nefarious intentions to make use of those platforms to spread falsehoods. But information technology, social media, is certainly not the only factor here. Other things we point to are just simply the way humans process information. There are characteristics of our information processing, like all the cognitive biases and heuristics that affect what we think and how we make decisions, like motivated reasoning. We like to be right. We seek out information that proves we're right. So this plays a big role in kind of confirmation of our false beliefs, and those beliefs then become entrenched. We also look at polarization, the role that not just political polarization, but social and economic and demographic polarization play in creating very insulated, homogenous groups of people in which alternative narratives can thrive. And there's a demand for this kind of unique narrative for each community. And those narratives can diverge substantially. And if there's no crosstalk, we never get a sharing of ideas, and that plays a role in the phenomenon. And then finally, we talk about the role of individual susceptibility and the role that education plays in that. The challenge here is that technology changes quickly and institutions like school change slowly. As a result, there's a gap between the skills that students get in school and then what they need to do when they enter the information environment. Adults face the same challenge. They didn't receive these skills in school either. And so that this gap between what people need to know to effectively manage and navigate the information environment in such polarized times and the skills they have don't match up. That creates this susceptibility, which just contributes then even more to the phenomena overall.
And Jennifer, it feels like all of this is happening more intensely now for the reasons you outlined: the ubiquity of the internet, information technology changes so quickly, the fact that schools can't keep up, polarization. And yet there must be historical precedents in our history. And I was wondering how you would characterize the magnitude of the problem we are experiencing today with respect to truth decay compared to previous historical periods.
That's a great question. I mean, we definitely have seen periods in the past that look similar in U.S. history. So some of the things that we point to in our research, like the 1880s to 1890s, where you have the rise of mass-produced newspapers and the phenomenon known as yellow journalism. Yellow journalism was characterized by exaggerated and outlandish stories that were put in newspapers to sell newspapers. That sounds familiar in some ways to today. We also look at the 1920s, 1930s. Here you have the rise of radio. Again, radio platforms were leveraged by powerful individuals to spread their opinions, much in the same way that cable news is used today. And then we look at the 60s and early 70s. Again, a period characterized by some of the same social dynamics as we have now, a lot of social unrest and division, polarization, and again, changes in information with the rise of television. So in all of these eras, we have this change in the information technology, which seems to open the door for a proliferation of false and misleading information as we grapple with this new technology. So there are a lot of similarities. And the key difference that we know between today and these previous periods is this increasing disagreement about objective facts and data. Certainly, there's been disagreement about facts and data in the past, so we're not pointing to the disagreement as being new, What we're pointing to as being new is this divergence between the direction of people's attitudes and the trajectory of data. So as we get more and more data about things like the safety of vaccines, which I mentioned before, or the safety of GMOs, we get more and more people believing that they are not safe. So that divergence does seem to be unique to this period and something that does make this period uniquely dangerous. And as you mentioned, social media could play a role in that, the internet, our ability to feel like experts because we have Google and other types of search engines at our fingertips. That could be playing a role in why we see this unique characteristic.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jennifer Kavanaugh. She's director of the Strategy, Doctrine, and Resources Program at the RAND Corporation, where she leads the Countering Truth Decay Initiative. She joins us via Microsoft Teams as we continue to practice social distancing. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And here's a shout out to a loyal and devoted listener, Isaiah Udo Uyo from Akwa, Ibom State in Nigeria. Thanks so much for your kind email. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Jennifer Kavanaugh, and we're discussing this phenomenon of truth decay. So Jennifer, speaking of our mostly foreign audience, how does America compare to other democracies around the world regarding truth decay? I mean, we normally associate propaganda, false narratives with authoritarian and totalitarian regimes, you know, regimes that normally, as a matter of course, trample on freedom of the press. But when our own freedom of speech, you know, allows for hate speech and disinformation, it seems like it's more of an insidious and dangerous trend to the integrity of democracy and the flow of truth and facts. And I was wondering to what extent we're seeing this phenomenon in other countries, in other democracies in particular.
I think that we do see some evidence of this phenomenon in other democracies. I think we can especially point to some examples in Europe, things like Brexit. Certainly there are examples in countries like France. We've done a little bit of work looking into whether or not we see the prevalence of the trends that characterize truth decay to the same extent, specifically in the European context more generally. And, you know, that work is still ongoing. We're definitely finding some evidence, but there are definitely differences. Differences because of America's unique political character, the political system, the individualism that Americans hold so important. Freedom of speech as being this paramount ideal that's protected by the First Amendment. So there are certainly differences. So I think, you know, we do see this trend at a global level. I think we see evidence of it in other areas as well. But I do think that it has some unique characteristics in the United States and probably in other countries as well because of the character of the people, the character of the political systems, the character of the social dynamics, things like that.
Jennifer Kavanaugh, what about the role of politicians here in the United States, whether members of Congress or the executive branch? Do you see a trend among politicians that are feeding and are somehow disseminating disinformation?
Well, we do identify political actors as one of what we call agents of truth decay. So you can imagine that truth decay is not a natural phenomenon like a hurricane. Certainly there's human intent behind it. There may be aspects of truth decay that take on a life of their own or seem to be self-generating, but there are agents that play a role in exacerbating it and spreading it. And political actors are one category of people that we identify as playing this agent role. Certainly not all political actors are contributing to the problem, but we do identify ways in which political actors, not just representatives or members of the government, but also political lobbying organizations that contribute to the problem. And they can do it not only by spreading falsehoods, but even just by cherry picking facts to make their point or sticking to a partisan line over the factual evidence or exhibiting a closed-mindedness to looking at evidence on the other side of an argument. So definitely political actors play a role. Other actors that we identify as playing an agent role, certainly foreign influence is one. been a lot of discussion about the role that Russia plays, China, Iran. Media can play a role. Again, not all aspects of the media, but certainly there are media actors that have partisan or economic motives that lead them to spread false or misleading information. And then we also point to academia and research. And again, in this area, it's not all researchers, not everyone who's working in academia, but certainly there are incentives, whether it's to publish articles or to make a name for yourself, to manipulate data or be misleading in the way you present data that can contribute to the problem. So there's, you know, many different actors that are playing a role in feeding this phenomenon.
Well, it seems to me that last agent, academia, that's extremely dangerous in insidious because that's the very institution that you rely on for objective information or data.
Yes, and I don't want to give the impression that even a majority of researchers are acting with that kind of intention, but I do think that you have to understand the role it can play. I mean, just look at the boost that the anti-vax movement got from the discredited Andrew Wakefield study about vaccines contributing to autism. That study has been disproven and retracted, and yet people still cite that study as the reason why they don't believe in the safety of vaccines. So one study like that can have a really far-reaching impact.
Well, thank you for putting that in context. Nonetheless, we all have to be critical thinkers when we consume research or any other material. And I have a question to follow up on the political actors, Jennifer, and that is, do you think that decay is worse on the right of the political spectrum?
Well, our research hasn't specifically tried to disentangle the differences across political lines. I mean, I would say that the decay happening on either side does appear different. And certainly if you're talking specifically on topics like election integrity, which we just experienced over the past 3 or 4 months, and in the context of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, in that space, most of the disinformation was on the right. But there are certainly issues, vaccines being a good case, where disinformation and decay seems to span the political spectrum. So I think it really depends on the context and the issues that you're discussing.
Jennifer, speaking of the horrific attack on the Capitol on January 6th, let's talk about the danger of conspiracy theories. Where do these crazy theories originate, such as QAnon and some of the beliefs that anti-government militias have been propagating? And don't forget, speaking of our history here in the United States, we have what we call survivalist cults also, and they're very anti-government. Where do these originate? How can they be fought? And, you know, how do they get so embedded, even when these theories are debunked over and over again, and people seem to continue to believe in them?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons why we see conspiracies pop up. I mean, one of the reasons that people cling to conspiracies is because it helps them to make sense of the world. There's certainly a lot of uncertainty in the world. We as human beings in general are not comfortable with uncertainty. And so conspiracy theories can help to tell a story that ties things together, that helps things to make sense, that gives individuals a set of principles or a story to live by. The reason why these often become so entrenched, I think, is twofold. One is that when you are part of a conspiracy, you often become part of a tribe of other people who believe in the same thing. And that sense of belonging can keep you involved, even if the principles themselves are disproven. In addition, I think that believing things like this can often be part of someone's identity. So when you're trying to convince someone that this conspiracy isn't true, you're also challenging what they see as their identity. And that's why they can be so difficult to dislodge. I think that during this pandemic, we've seen a real proliferation of these conspiracies because there is so much uncertainty and so much dislocation, and people are grasping at anything that can help to give them answers. So that compounds the challenge that we would face normally. In terms of, you know, how you break the hold of these conspiracies, it's very difficult. There's, you know, a number of different theories of how you might approach this. Certainly for some, seeing evidence that their conspiracy, that their story isn't true, can help to open the door to other types of information. But it's really important to think about who's providing that other type of information. It's usually not an outsider. It's usually someone that person already trusts, whether it's a family member or someone from the religious community. So it's a tricky balance of providing the more realistic view while also identifying the right messenger so that person is open to the information in the first place.
No question about it. You know, we're seeing even, for example, within the Republican Party, Many in the Republican Party have denounced QAnon and other conspiracy theories, and yet there seems to be a faction that still clings to that. So there are diehards in many groups that will probably not let go. But let's go back to social media, because as you said, in today's world, compared to other historical periods where we have seen truth decay, it's just exacerbated by social media, what we call, you know, citizen journalists, people who just write things on Facebook or whatever platform. There are no editors. There's no way to verify. And many people have decided, you know, that that doesn't really matter. To what extent do you think, in addition to social media, the rise of cable networks, which unlike broadcast media, seem to contribute to the blurring of fact and opinion. These cable networks, both on the right and on the left, but particularly on the right, we're seeing are motivated by profit over fairness and objectivity. I don't know why they are not governed by what is called the fairness doctrine, which used to, and I believe still governs, broadcast networks, whereby our Federal Communications Commission requires that holders of broadcast licenses present controversial issues of public importance in a manner that is honest, equitable, and balanced.
So the fairness doctrine, you're right in describing it. It is no longer enforced, but you are right that when it was enforced, it only applied to network television. There's mixed evidence on whether the fairness doctrine actually achieved its objectives. On the one hand, certainly it did require that broadcasters provide perspectives on both sides of an issue. But on the other hand, to kind of avoid getting in trouble, there's some evidence that broadcasters just avoided talking about public issues altogether. And so that isn't necessarily a public good in the sense that people need broadcasters to be providing them with that information. In terms of the role that cable news plays, you know, I do think that cable news plays a role in this blurring of the line between fact and opinion. Certainly, cable news, because of their business model, is geared towards providing what I would call outrage journalism, things, commentary, opinions that are intended to stir up emotion, to cause you to have an emotional, typically angry or scared or anxiety-filled response that will make you keep watching. And so that type of communication and broadcasting is not the same kind of fact-based investigative journalism that provides kind of that basis of factual evidence for people to make decisions. I think it's important to keep in mind that cable audiences themselves, even for, you know, the primetime shows, are pretty small overall, much smaller than broadcast networks, much smaller than newspaper subscriptions, even after newspaper subscriptions have fallen. So I think that it's important to keep in mind that the actual number of people watching this is small, but that those watchers tend to be very devoted to those shows and also then to be kind of some of the most prolific spreaders of false information in online circles. So when we think about the chain of information, I think cable news plays an important role in shaping the narrative that then spreads outward from there.
You mentioned newspapers. Do you think that the demise of like local newspapers and even disdain we are seeing toward major standard bearers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Wall Street Journal and others, do you think that contributes to truth decay?
Well, I think that anything that removes objective and fact-based sources of information from the information environment is not a good thing. Local news has value because it does tend to be that type of information, and it does tend to provide individuals with very detailed and specific fact-based information that allows them to make decisions about their lives because it's reporting on local conditions. For some people, they don't have, you know, the New York Times. It may not even be sold at local convenience stores. So that local paper serves as a lifeline of information. So losing that leaves them in what some people call like a news desert. And if they don't get that information, then they have no source of evidence and facts on which to base their decisions.
Picking up on what you said, people are getting more and more information from social media platforms where there are no editors. There's no real oversight, even though Facebook and Twitter are trying to flag hate speech or outright lies. To what extent do you blame these social media platforms for truth decay or as a major factor?
Social media certainly plays a role in this problem. I think that oftentimes that role is overstated. It's certainly not only a social media problem. We've talked about the role that cable news plays. We see blurring of the line between fact and opinion, even in major newspapers. So this is not a phenomenon that's isolated and restricted to social media. I think that the major role that social media plays is in amplifying the spread of disinformation and making it easier for people to do that. Because it used to be, if you wanted to spread false information, you had to tell people. So your ability to spread it was limited to the number of people you could tell. Now, with a push of a button, you can spread false information to millions of people. They can spread that to millions of people. So from my perspective, it really does play this role of a conduit. I think it's important, though, to recognize that social media is not all bad. A democratized information environment certainly removes some of the filters and the checks that used to be in place to remove some of the low-quality information. But in the old information system, information was dominated in the hands of just a few people. It was controlled by mostly white men. So in the current environment, minorities, women, people who didn't have a voice in the past now have a platform. And so one thing that we found in our research was that women and minority populations were much more likely to express that they felt that the media environment now was more reliable than in the past. And part of that may be because they see themselves, they feel represented. And so it's important to balance when we think about the role social media plays in truth decay, the negative things that we see, such as the amplification of false information, with the positive things, which is a greater diversification of access to this platform.
And Jennifer, as we close, I'd like you to suggest any recommendations RAND Corporation has that you're formulating in the process of trying to counter this trend of truth decay. What are your major recommendations for individuals, other groups, civil society, politicians, and our schools? You know, what can be done to both counter and prevent truth decay?
Truth decay is a multifaceted problem, and it's going to require a multifaceted solution. So I think that we can think about solutions from the supply side and the demand side. On the demand side, on the side of the consumer, I think that one of the key things that we focus on is education, whether that's media literacy, civic education. These things can provide individuals with the tools they need to sift through different types of information, to spend the time to analyze, identify bias, synthesize different perspectives, understand the role that the media plays in a democracy. It would also include things like science literacy, understanding of statistics, so that people can be informed and effectively navigate the information environment. And it doesn't have to be limited to children. We think about these education initiatives as being centered in schools, but certainly adults need this type of education as well. So on the demand side, I think that's where I would focus. On the supply side, I think there are things that media providers and broadcasters can do to help consumers. Making sure that the line between fact and opinion is clear is one. Even in major newspapers and broadcast television, we often see this blending of commentary and fact. And I think that anything that we can do to make it easier for consumers, labeling information, making sure that those two are separate, can be helpful so that information consumers then know when they're reading fact and when they're reading opinion. And this is not to say that opinion is bad, just that it's different. And we want to make sure that people understand the type of information they're getting. And then the final thing I think I would focus on, at least in the media space, would be thinking about how we want to manage or govern the online space. We talked about the role that different types of disruptive technologies have played over time in phenomena like truth decay. And those have gradually ebbed because we developed systems to manage the new information environment. So here I'm not talking about regulation, but I am talking about rules of the road and ways that we are able to govern the online space to make it work for us so that we can leverage the advantages without all the risks. The final thing I'll say is that I think polarization plays a big role, and we can't have a solution to this problem without tackling that as well. That's a harder problem to tackle. We do see from research that having bridging conversations, bringing different groups together to have these types of dialogues, can be really valuable in helping to bridge those divides. Rebuilding trust in government, things like building government transparency, increasing diversity so that people see themselves in government, and really, again, going back to education, making sure that people have an understanding of what it means to live in a democracy, both the government's responsibilities and their responsibilities, can help to rebuild and restore trust in that domain that may have some benefits in terms of bridging those divides.
Jennifer Cavanaugh is a political scientist at the RAND Corporation. She leads the organization's Countering Truth Decay initiative. Jennifer, thank you so much for your keen insights on this very fascinating and critical topic.
Thanks for the discussion today.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.